Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for Thursday, August 19th, 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by Tribune CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hi, Elise.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott from the Tribune and KUT News.
Hello.
Today, our three topics are House lawmakers and their ethics problems, a new deficit in this year's budget, and terror babies, my favorite topic. Let's start with Ben and Evan. Ben?
So we've had two lawmakers over the last 2 weeks with ethics complaints, or not ethics complaints, but ethics issues coming up. Patrick Rose, for the last couple of weeks, has been hammered by his political opponent on whether or not he's using, whether or not he correctly identified that he had a loan for a car, and then the fact that he's using campaign money to fill the gas tank. And then this week, Joe Driver had his week screwed by being informed that he's been double-dipping on reimbursements from the state and from his campaign.
World's most unfortunate quote, I gotta say.
No, great quote. The best quote ever.
No, fantastic quote from here, you know, but from his standpoint, you know, somebody over in his office put a forehead forcibly against their hand, you know, just... Yeah.
And, you know, I think that we've just got such a cynical political world at the moment. I mean, when I talked with Patrick Rose's opponent, whose name I'm going to forget.
Jason Isaac.
Thank you.
The custodian down the hall knows his name, Ben. Keep up.
But luckily, I have all of you to help me out here. So Jason, when I talked to him, it was very obvious. This is a campaign move. He talked about how the fact that he's spending money from his campaign filling his gas tank puts him out of touch with the voters of his district. I mean, out of touch with the voters of his district is only a political message.
And Rose argued that the reason he's spending money on gas for his gas tank, you know, to give him equal time, is to stay in touch with his constituents.
Right, because it's a three-county district.
Driving around a three-county district that's about... What's Dripping Springs? 25 or 30 miles from the Capitol, drives in, you know, it's all work-related travel. Work pays for it.
And Jason Isaac apparently had spent some money on...
Well, he did. He spent the money out of the part of the report that is a candidate... It records a candidate spending his own money on gas. He spent his own money on gas. It's recorded in his report. He's not using his campaign money.
Right. So, you know, so that's more of a political thing. Then you have Driver, who is doing something that seems a lot less.
That's the guy who should have the gas problem, right?
How can you know that it's not wrong to expense both the government and your campaign and get the money from both places?
It seems like it's hard for there to be an outcry that something should happen. And my question is, so where's the fault? Is there a problem with the Ethics Commission that if something like double dipping is serious enough, he's not just immediately out of office? Is there a problem with us because everybody views it, us people in general, that everybody views it as a cynical political thing? I mean, why don't things happen when we find things like this out?
The problem with Joe Driver, unless there's some explanation for this that I've not read or don't understand, is Joe Driver. Not since George Costanza has there been so offensive a double dip.
Let's say what happened here. This is a Jay Root of the Associated Press.
Oh yeah, let's give Jay credit. This is a great piece of reporting.
It's a really good story, and basically he reported that Joe Driver was billing expenses, hotels, travel that are work related to his campaign. And also billing them to the state.
So he's getting two expense checks.
Something above 20 grand in the period that Jay looked at. And Driver's response to this was, you know, you've screwed up my whole week.
This pretty well screws my week, he said. Not sounding guilty or anything.
So, and there's right. Basically two sets of, you know, to get to Ben's question, there's basically two sets of records on something like this. The campaign finance records are pretty available. The Ethics Commission is online. This stuff is, you know, pretty attainable. You know, if you get bored on a Saturday night, you can go look at it. The other record is the House expense reports, which are kept by the House administration, and those are not easy to get to. You have to go over and request them and, you know, tell them exactly what you want and go through sort of a 15-year-old open records process instead of a modern open records process. The problem with a lot of these things is that, you know, it's sort of a hiding in plain sight thing. A lot of these things are available in public records. You just have to take the time and effort to go look at the public records. And usually the only people who do that are political opponents.
Right.
The other point that we should make is that these records get destroyed. So we know that Joe Driver has double billed at least $17,000, but he's been in in the House since 1991. Everything from 1991 to 2005 is already gone. And so,
it could conceivably be more.
Oh, it could. If he's done it ever since he got in office,
right.
That's a lot more money. And that raises the question of why we shouldn't have something in the statute where we keep these records longer.
It's got this Orwellian name. It's called the Records Retention Schedule. And a records retention schedule in every agency is the legal description of when they can destroy stuff.
It's really the records destruction schedule.
Exactly right.
And of course, we all in the press would be advocating loudest of all for transparency, open government, you know,
You can argue in a society that's based on paper that, you know, with Indiana Jones like warehouses full of government records and everything. Hey, we got to destroy this stuff once in a while. But, you know, you can put so many government records, you'd put a whole agency on a hard drive now. It's not like there's a big expense. You just convert it. And
this is something where the public needs to be with the press in demanding accountability. The same people on the left and right who are loudest in opposition to what goes on and does not go on in the Capitol, they need to join forces and demand accountability on the part of our legislators by way of open government and transparency. And then they've got to demand that records are retained and that records are more easily, to your point, Ross, more easily accessible to people who want them so that we can ferret out the Joe Drivers of the world. Now, the Joe Driver situation is fascinating from an ethical standpoint in that it seems impossible, unless we're missing something, that Joe Driver didn't know that he was double-dipping.
He got two checks.
He is claiming that it was an innocent mistake, nothing to see here, keep walking. But, I mean, come on.
I mean, if you get two reimbursement checks for the same airline ticket,
I would like to be there to hear the explanation. You know, it's like when your kid gets in trouble and he's like, okay, so explain this one to me. This better be good.
Right. Of course, you know, until there's some action taken against, if there is action taken against Joe Driver, and maybe that's Ben's point, will there be action taken against Joe Driver?
And not saying...
We don't know ultimately what the penalty is.
Right. I mean, we don't know...
Couple of reports that the Travis County District Attorney's looking at it.
This is the Public Integrity Unit is looking?
Right, right.
Yeah, the one that is run famously out of the DA's office.
The question would be, you know, on something like this, whether you misuse state funds. You know, you're basically...
Right.
Misusing state money, you know?
That seems like it's could be a little more serious. But again, so that is my question. So where, at what point is something serious enough for something to happen? So maybe we don't have cynical views. Yeah. So we don't have something. And unfortunately, you're right. People on the left and right are both clamoring for things like open government. Unfortunately, when the opposite, when it's the person in their party that is hammered with something like this, instead of joining in with the other side to say, yes, this is why we should do it, it's obviously these are political shenanigans by your side.
It's a partisan deal.
I think it's working. Go ahead.
And speaking of the politics, though, even after all this has happened, Joe Driver is still in the 60-40 district where he's likely to be reelected.
Well, he's
this
in
fall.
The driver's seat. He
may win this thing, and it may be because the district's drawn that way, but this is how this is supposed to work. You bring things to light, voters look at them, they make a decision, and they go, you know, see or no.
I think it's very interesting to imagine that Joe Driver in Garland, who is representing a district, as you say, that is overwhelmingly Republican against an opponent who, until this week, you couldn't have picked out of a police lineup, whose name you wouldn't have recognized, and who presumably has very little money, or did until all this broke, to mount a competitive campaign against him. In Linda Harper Brown's district, we've talked about her many times, the reality is that's a very conservative district. Even though she was on the edge of losing last time, her ethics problems involving the car that she was driving do not necessarily guarantee her defeat. There was a suggestion made by one of our colleagues in the press this week, I thought somewhat incredibly, that the combination of the Linda Harper Brown and Joe Driver ethics issues suddenly put the House in play. Let me say this straight out. No, it doesn't put the House in play. It makes two seats that were not thought to be competitive. It does not mean that those Republicans are going to lose, and it assumes that the Democrats have races that they can snatch from Republicans in what is shaping up to be the worst year for Democrats in the history of Democrats. It just does not present as, you know, this is a good thing necessarily for the Democrats. It's a better thing for the Democrats. Those two seats are now competitive in a way that they were not previously.
Right.
But there's no guarantee that our favorite challenger, from a name standpoint, Holden Wang, is going to beat Linda Harper Brown any more than Jamie Doris is going to beat Joe Driver. It just means that their chances have been upgraded from 0%. And this kind of ties back to your point, Ben, which is we live in an era of no consequences. You know, I mean, Rod Blagojevich got off on 23 out of 24 charges right. this week. What kind of a world is this?
And he was able to invoke the Tea Party to hopefully keep from being reindicted.
This is like, this is basically, this is O.J. Simpson right. justice is what it is. You know, how guilty do you have to be to get convicted of anything these days? And how guilty do you have to be for there to be consequences visited upon you legally or politically these days?
You have to have a tape of a guy trying to sell a U.S. Senate seat. You know, you can't get a conviction without a tape of a guy
right, of
trying
course,
to sell.
No, and cussing a lot.
And cussing a lot.
Yeah. So in the
that,
so in
well,
the
well,
end,
that only got him lying to the government.
Right.
So in the end, we don't know what Joe Driver did or did not do. And as you say, right. Ross, you know, you want to hear what the explanation is, and I want to hear what the explanation right. is, and all that.
We know
fine.
He got two expense checks.
We do know that he got two expense checks. He more or less copped to that.
Right.
Rationale and motivation.
I didn't know I was doing this. Right, I didn't do anything wrong.
But
I'm going to write you a check.
What we do not necessarily know what he did, but we do know that historically it takes an enormous amount to get somebody out of office. And this may just not be enough.
Right. Right.
Let's stay on the money topic and move to our state's budget woes this year.
There's a hole. You know,
and this is separate from the $18 billion hole projected for the next budget.
Let me try to make this as quick and as unboring as possible. So the state has a...
So, how's that working out so far?
Let's see how this is going.
Right.
So the
boring, not unboring.
The controller goes to Wall Street to borrow money for cash flow needs. Basically what happens is the state's money at the beginning of the year doesn't come in as quickly as its expenses pile up, so you have to borrow some money to cover that gap. That gap is $10.8 billion. The state's borrowing $7.8 billion, and I'm going to take the other $3 billion from other funds. And it turns out in all the disclosures for all of this stuff, the controller revealed quietly that the state has a $1.3 billion deficit in the current budget, and that we're going to have an immediate and sort of striking cash flow problem at the end of the budget of about $236 million.
And it is unconstitutional to run a deficit in this state?
It's unconstitutional to write a budget that has a deficit in it. But once that budget is written...
It's not unconstitutional to have one.
It's not unconstitutional for the economy to go south and cause you problems. You got to fix the thing. The $18 billion that you're talking about is going forward. They believe that the next budget they write, if you continue current services at the expected cost of those and you continue current revenues, in other words, you don't have tax increases or anything, at the current rate they're running, they think the gap there is going to be $18 billion. So problem number one, we have a deficit in the current budget we have to solve. Problem number two, we're going forward into a budget that's got an $18 billion gap. Now, what's interesting about this is, this being an election year, the controller hasn't said any of this stuff publicly. And, you know, she's addressed the $18 billion saying, well, I don't know, a lot of people are throwing numbers around. And the deficit they haven't officially acknowledged. And in fact, if you call, as I did, the controller's office and say, so I'm looking at these documents, they say to Wall Street, we have a $1.3 billion deficit. Are you guys saying there's a deficit? And they say, well, our official revenue estimate is not out yet, and so we're not saying anything about deficits. You get into the semantic world. But, you know, basically, the economy's bad, and the state budget reflects that.
Now, how is that $1 billion, how is that different from, because the legislature comes in and passes an emergency supplemental bill, usually the first of the session.
A supplemental bill is a bill, it's like a mini budget. It's like, our budget isn't working, and here's the correction. So they'll come in January and say, we're going to take this much money out of, say, the rainy day fund, apply it to the current budget instead of the next budget so that we end the year at balance and so that we start the next budget, which we have to do, at balance.
Is the deficit, though, is it much larger? I mean, is this going to be a larger supplemental bill than we've had in the past?
Well, we don't know yet, and we don't know that 1.3 is the whole problem. The reason that the state's only borrowing $7.8 billion for its cash flow needs when its cash flow needs are $10.8 billion is because a year ago, the state's leadership, the controller, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the speaker, looked at the situation and said, well, our cash flow needs won't be any greater than $7.8 billion. They set the number. Since that time, over the last year, the state budget has gotten $3 billion worse than it was. And you're asking me what it's going to be like in a year.
We know next session is going to be.
Soon.
Right. But and although these are separate issues.
Right.
They're related because, for instance, if you drain X amount of money from the rainy day fund to pay down the deficit,
then it's not available.
It's not available for you as a potential solution,
right,
to solve the $18 billion problem.
Well, right. Maybe that is why whenever you talk to anyone on the Republican side that has control of the money, they say they only think they have the votes for half of the rainy day fund. They're already talking.
Maybe they'll end up only having half after they pay off the first.
That's part of it, and we very quickly get into budget politics. But you know, part of the deal here is if you've got an expected shortfall in the next budget of $18 billion. Pick a number out of your hat, $15 billion, $10 billion, whatever it is. If you've got an expected shortfall, that means either you're going to have to find some revenue or you're going to have to cut some programs, and that's where the fight starts. If you're defending a program, when they did this in 2003, they cut $10 billion from the budget. They cut a lot of health and human services programs, and they also, in order to balance the thing, raised a bunch of fees. Most famously, they untethered tuition rates, which used to be set by the legislature, and let those go to free market rates, and everybody knows what's happened to the cost of college since then.
So who's to blame? Is the economy to blame? Is there an individual in Texas who should have had their hands on this wheel a little bit more firmly? What's the story?
Well, I mean, the economy is to blame, and you have to point out that the state's top three leaders, Perry, Dewhurst, and Strauss, last spring said to the agencies, hey, you guys got to cut 5% of your current budget now because the economy is not doing very well. This budget deficit that is now estimated at $1.3 billion would have been $2.5 billion without that intervention. So, you know, there's an intervention there. Some of this is just the economy going south.
Right.
Some of it is, you know, sales taxes aren't performing. They're not performing because people weren't buying stuff for a long time at the rates they were expected to. The state's business franchise tax doesn't produce like it does. All of these things are, you know, recession-related problems.
Is it potentially a campaign issue?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're Bill White and you're going after Rick Perry and he's saying the state's all golden and the economy's great and the daisies pop out every morning and the sun is shining, and you say, well, wait a minute, you got this, you're running a red budget. Since the 2003 budget, which was in the vicinity of $110 billion, you've run the price of running the state government up to $183 billion. It's got a deficit at the end of it. This isn't good fiscal management.
And the Perry response is, hey, trial lawyer, owe tax return.
Right.
Diversion, right.
Shut your mouth, right.
Yeah. White's been trying to make hay of this $18 billion budget deficit for a while, and then even as he makes this argument that Perry doesn't work very much, he says, you know, He doesn't work very much in the face of an $18 billion deficit and all this, but I don't feel like it's really gotten legs. I mean,
it's like trying. You
I'm
know,
not
talking
sure this
about,
relates to people.
About numbers is like trying to get people to join the chess club in high school. It's just, you know, people aren't interested in it. Their eyes glaze over, and it's hard to connect to your daily life.
I was just going to say, this is also a year where the idea of smaller government is extremely popular with people. And you talk about an $18 billion deficit as a possible way to snip that government a little.
And a $1.3 billion deficit at a time when no other state's economies are in the hole is one thing. A $1.3 billion deficit at a time when every other state's economy is in a worse hole is another thing.
Yeah, quick piece of math. The Texas problem is about 0.1% of its budget.
Right.
It's a lot better off than being in California or being
in some ways, the Perry campaign can argue, you know, yes, we have this deficit, but Texas is still significantly better off than other states.
Right. Yeah, $18 billion is the entire budget for
Iowa. You might be close there, Ben. So our final topic is something that's been in the national news this
week.
Heard
nothing at all about this.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You know, Evan, you've changed if you have not heard about this.
I used to be good. I did used to be good.
Sorry.
Thank God for these people. We would have nothing to do.
So Louis Gohmert, actually in June on the House floor, congressman from the 1st District up in Tyler from Texas, claimed that a former FBI official told him of an insidious plot in which pregnant women would deliver babies in the U.S. who would then, 20, 30 years later, come back, get trained as terrorists, and then come back to wreak havoc on the U.S. And, you know, this, he claims, is a gaping hole, quote unquote, in our security.
I can't believe you're talking about this. All of our throats will now be cut.
That's right. And he also will not give up his sources, saying that he heard that, or his source said that throats would be cut if this happened. Debbie Riddle has also followed suit and is also sourcing former FBI officials, to which a former FBI official came out on CNN to say, I don't know why there's random FBI officials roaming the halls of the Texas legislature.
This is the screenplay for the first Alien movie. You go plant a bunch of eggs on a planet.
The screenplay for Salt,
like immigration version of the Manchurian Candidate.
I guess, right.
This is actually very close to the plot of Salt, where children get get trained as terrorists very early on in their lives and then come back after they grow up. So, a lot of attention focused on this. Debbie Riddle and Louis Gohmert are really standing their ground And
well, and they both made crazy TV appearances this week. Right. I mean, you know, as I like to say, they're talkers now. I mean, they both went on the Anderson Cooper show, I guess, separately, right? And mm-hmm. Made spectacles of themselves, either for better or for worse, depending on which side of this issue you're on. That's giving everybody a lot of ground here.
It is. Very generous of you.
It's you know, I mean, you just got to watch these videos. It's just an incredible... It's an incredible thing.
Right, and South Carolina usually gets to be the national state laughingstock.
In fact, Jon Stewart said last night in a very long piece, blistering piece, mocking Gohmert, are you sure this guy's not from South Carolina? Which, you know, I guess we take that
That's
as a compliment,
probably a dig
right?
at Colbert.
Yeah.
Right, but, you know, I guess on the flip side, not many people are coming out to defend Gohmert besides Riddle, right?
Well, you know, this happens to both parties from time to time, where somebody in your party goes so far out that no one takes up their defense, and that there's actually a threat to the brand. So if you sort of look at the big map here, the Republicans are looking at this year, which is looking up to this point like a really Republican year. People are mad at Obama. They're mad about health care. The economy hasn't turned yet, yada, yada, yada. And then the Republicans, given this opportunity, at least two Republicans, go on national television and sort of make a spectacle of themselves. And every day that people are talking about something like this, they're not talking about the problems with the Democrats. This is not a win for the Republicans,
but
and it's hard on the brand.
But tie this back to what we were talking about earlier. Neither Debbie Riddle nor Louie Gohmert is going to lose the bids for re-election that come up this November.
No, but it's an association thing. If you're Chet Edwards and you're running for your life in a seat in Central Texas. Chet Edwards is a congressman from Waco. He's got a very tough challenge from Bill Flores of Bryan, and he's defending himself. He's going in front of a group of, say, conservative Democrats or a group of independents and asking them for their vote. In order to peel votes away from a Bill Flores, he's going to say, did you see Debbie Riddle on TV? Did you see Louie Gohmert? That's his party.
Well, and it could, I mean, not that Gohmert...
Right. Although there may be parts of that district in which Gohmert and Riddle are folk heroes as a result of that.
Well, that may be right.
But, you know, it kind of is similar to Michelle Bachmann talking about real Americans or congressmen with un-American feelings. Her opponent, who nobody knew his name and he had no money at all of a sudden got like $2 million from a coordinated fundraising effort from Democrats.
And Bachmann...
But so did
and
she.
But he came close. I mean, he still lost, but it wasn't a 20-point race. It was a 5-point race, 4-point race, something like that. And so, you know, Gohmert may not lose, but it'd be interesting to see if all of a sudden he has an opponent that has more money than what's in his pocket.
Reeve Hamilton did a story for us a few months ago about the Democrat running against Joe Barton after Barton apologized to BP. And, you know, the theory behind the story was, you know, sometimes you're the guy who's lucky enough to draw an opponent who does something unbelievably controversial and you've got a race. Has anybody heard from that guy again?
No, I think that was the high point of his day.
The last moment.
Michelle Bachmann, by the way, has turned this into, you know, lemon into lemonade. She's in Dallas either this week or next raising money, and the tagline, Highland Park maybe, and the tagline for this fundraiser is Nancy Pelosi's number one target, Michelle Bachmann, will be in Dallas to raise money, help her fight the fight.
So this may ultimately help Gohmert and Riddle in their own little world.
That's right. The thing. I mean, this is a topic for another podcast, but it seems like these days, the more extreme you are, the more attention you get, and the more you can bank on that, you know? It's like being a reality TV star.
I have to tell you that, you know, I was not necessarily thinking that Debbie Riddle should be in the hot seat in the Texas Tribune conversation series, but this has made Debbie Riddle a commodity, and so we do have Debbie Riddle on September 15th, and I expect that she will be as resolute in her defense of her position then as she's been on television, because there's no margin in her not being.
Right.
That's what she believes.
Right.
And for her crowd in Tomball, the people who elect her every 2 years and are likely to elect her again, this is red meat.
Go get them, girl.
Let's go get them.
Right.
We hope you'll be there for that and that you'll be back with us next week when we return. On behalf of Evan, Ross, and Ben, I'm Elise. Thanks for listening.